Hi everyone, Will here with a solo documentary episode about a significant figure in the history of American popular culture. Much of what I know about this subject is thanks to the research of Catherine Fuller Seely in her excellent book, Jack Benny and the Golden Age of American Radio Comedy. I highly recommend it. I'd like to begin with a clip from the March 28th, 1937 episode of The Jell-O Program starring Jack Benny. Jack, the star comedian, is on a train with his co-stars, traveling from Chicago to California, when they encounter a porter.
How'd you sleep, Mary?
I was up half the night writing an Easter poem. You want to hear it?
Not now, Mary.
A dear old Easter.
Hey, porter, porter.
Yes?
What time do we get to Albuquerque?
Who?
Albuquerque.
I don't know. Do we stop there?
Well, certainly we stop there.
My, my. I better go up and tell the engineer about that.
Yeah, do that.
What's the name of that town again?
Albuquerque.
Albuquerque. What's they going to think up next?
Nobody listening would have predicted that this would become a historic moment in the show. There was nothing unusual about this character, a stereotypical black porter of the kind that regularly appeared in movies and radio in the Jim Crow era. But a few weeks later, on May 2nd, the voice returned, this time as a waiter in a Western sketch.
Well, we gotta have some victuals to go with this.
Where's the waiter?
There he is!
Hey, Pierre! Pierre?
Yes, sir, boss? Did you call me?
Yes, what do you got that's good to eat?
Man, you're in the wrong place.
Let's see that bill of fare. What about this roast beef?
I wouldn't encourage that.
You gotta eat something. Are the lamb chops all right?
I highly recommend them in the negative.
More appearances followed throughout the year, always in minor roles, until December 26th, when Jack had a new valet, Rochester Van Jones. At first an amusing side character, Rochester would quickly become a core member of the show's repertory company.
Oh, hello. What is it, Rochester?
What time are we leaving for San Francisco?
Well, we're going to drive up bright and early tomorrow morning. We'll leave about 5 a.m.
If you want me to go, you better make that 7.
Listen, you'll go when I go. And we're going to drive up there in my Maxwell. So put on that chauffeur's uniform I bought you.
You mean those gloves?
Yeah. Say, how are you coming along with the packing?
Fine. I put in your sport coat, your brown suit, and your gray suit.
That's good. Now pack my blue suit, too.
Oh, you don't want that.
I said pack it.
All right, but I'm going to have trouble getting it off your father.
By the 1940s, Rochester was a genuine multimedia star, celebrated in both the black and white presses as a goodwill ambassador for race relations, bridging divides at the height of Jim Crow. By the 1950s and 60s, many regarded him as a different kind of symbol, a stereotype of black subservience in the Uncle Tom tradition. By the time the show ended, Rochester was an American institution, but with the civil rights movement in full swing, he was also an outmoded one. In this episode, we're going to look back at Eddie Anderson, the most famous African-American comedian of the first half of the 20th century.
The Jack Benny Program, transcribed and presented by Lucky Strike.
The Jack Benny Program ran for more than three decades, on radio from 1932 to 1955, and on television from 1949 to 1965. And for many of those years, it was the most popular comedy show on American airwaves. When Benny died in 1974, the New York Times wrote that he was perhaps the most constantly funny of America's funny men. This is worth noting because the show's innovations have become so omnipresent that they can be difficult to even identify today. Beginning as a standard variety show, it evolved throughout the 1930s into being a show about a show, with Benny and his co-stars playing versions of themselves, putting on the show we're listening to. Among the most prominent of the ensemble cast were Don Wilson, the announcer, Phil Harris, the bandleader, Dennis Day, the singer, and Mary Livingston, Benny's real-life wife, playing a sort of platonic foil for the host.
Turn on the radio, Sophie.
Did I tell you about the place called Doo-Wah-Diddy? It ain't no town, it ain't no city, it's awful small.
Hey,
awful
they started the program without me.
She's got basement.
It's my own fault.
So
turn off the radio.
Basement full.
What's griping you, bud?
Plenty. They started the program without me.
How do you like that, Sophie? This bum's got a ticket to the program and he wants him to wait till he gets there.
The show deftly managed this cast in a sophisticated soundscape, aided by the many contributions of Mel Blanc, most famous as the voice of Bugs Bunny. Here he is providing the sound effect for Jack's dilapidated car, the Maxwell. Benny was an unusually generous host. He saw the value in letting his supporting players get laughs, and wasn't worried about them stealing a scene. He was smart enough to know that as long as his name was in the title of the show, every laugh was his. Unique among vaudeville comedy stars, he saw the value in self-deprecation, instead of creating a persona that was smug and clever, like a Bob Hope or a Ted Healy, he developed a character who was vain and miserly.
And now, folks, if you will look to the right, you will see Claudette Colbert's house. Next to it is Spencer Tracy's residence. And here on the left is the home of Jack Bennett.
This is where I get off, driver. Stop the bus.
Did you stow away again?
What?
Take off that beard. I know you.
Don't be sarcastic, driver. This isn't the only bus that goes to Beverly Hills.
It's the only free one.
Never mind. Stop the bus.
It's these character traits, more than any one joke or comedy routine, that defined him. Over the years, he became more than just a comedian. His comic persona inspired a self-contained universe. For example, his cheapness led to a running gag about the vault under his mansion where he kept his money. This excerpt from a 1945 broadcast will give you an idea of the universe the show's technical team was able to create with sound.
I better get it out of the safe now. Heavy enough, huh?
Oh, who goes there?
It's only me, Ed. It's okay.
Oh, hello, Mr. Benny.
How have you been, Ed?
Oh, fine, fine. Oh, by the way, Mr. Benny.
Yeah?
Who won the election?
Okay, Ed, you have a nice Christmas?
Yes. Quiet, but nice.
Good, good. Oh, Ed, I just want to open my safe for a minute.
Oh, yes, sir. Shall I turn my back?
No, it's all right. Now, let's see. The combination of the safe is right to 45, left to 160, back to 15, then left to 110. There.
Jack's cheapness culminated in this moment, possibly the most famous gag in the show's history.
Hey, Bud. Bud.
Huh?
Got a match?
Match? Yes, I have one right here.
Don't make a move. This is a stick-up.
What?
You hate me.
Mister, put down that gun.
Shut up. Now, come on. Your money or your life? Look, Bud, I said your money or your life. I'm thinking it over.
The relationship between Benny and his audience was built over decades. For a shortcut to appreciating him, I recommend seeking out what is unquestionably his best film performance in Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be, where he plays a vain, second-rate Shakespearean actor who becomes involved in an anti-fascist plot.
Her husband is that great, great Polish actor, Joseph Tura. You've probably heard of him.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I saw him on the stage when I was in Warsaw once before the war.
Really?
What he did to Shakespeare, we are doing now to Poland.
Hmm. Goodbye, Colonel.
Goodbye, Professor.
On the rare occasions when white audiences saw black actors and entertainers in movies in the 1930s and 40s, they tended to be comedy relief like Mantan Moreland and Willie Best, who performed under the name Sleep and Eat, or roles like servants and porters, the most famous example being Hattie McDaniel's Oscar-winning performance from Gone with the Wind. Discussing these performers' legacies is fraught terrain. Spike Lee pointedly used the names Mantan and Sleep and Eat for the minstrel characters in his film Bamboozled. For her part, Hattie McDaniel is alleged to have said, "I'd rather play a maid and make $700 than be a maid and make seven." It's worth noting that a comedian like Moreland or Best was often hired by B-movie studios to entice underserved black audiences, but in roles that would not alienate theater owners and lawmakers in crucial markets in the American South. Fearing Southern boycotts, the corporations and ad agencies that sponsored the major radio shows discouraged the employment of black performers. Rare exceptions included Orson Welles' use of black jazz musicians on his Orson Welles Radio Almanac, and a short-lived show that starred the jazz musician Louis Armstrong in 1937. That show ended after its skittish sponsor bowed out within a few weeks. This fear did not extend to white actors playing black, as in the case of one of the most popular radio comedies of its day, Amos and Andy.
Did you fellas sell 3,000 pens already?
Well, no, not the entire amount.
Then how many pens is you sold?
Two.
Ethnic stereotypes were such common currency in this era of comedy that there was a whole category of performer in vaudeville known as a dialect comedian. Consider Chico Marx's outrageous Italian accent. The Jack Benny Show traded in many ethnic voices. Another recurring character, Mr. Kitzel, was an outlandish Jewish stereotype. One reason why radio writers leaned heavily on ethnic stereotypes was for the practical reason that on radio, no two voices in a scene could sound too alike, and heavy accents were able to pop. Eddie Anderson kept being hired back through 1937 because the writers liked his raspy voice. But a voice, like any musical instrument, depends on the virtuosity of the person playing it, and it was Anderson's dry wit and razor-sharp comic timing that made him a star.
Just leave me alone.
Okay. I wonder what's wrong with him. He's kept himself locked in the den all day. The last time he brooded like this was when his girlfriend, Gladys Zabisco, broke their engagement. Then she sent back the ring and he was happy again. Wonder what's ailing him. Maybe bet on a horse. No, if Mr. Benny bet on a horse and that horse lost, he'd beat it to death with his bare hands. I just can't figure out what's the matter with him.
Rochester, if you don't mind, I'll have my dinner served in bed.
What's the matter, boss? Don't you feel good? You've been brooding all day.
I haven't been brooding. If I want to lock myself in the den, it's my own business.
Wait a minute, boss.
Huh?
Have you been crying?
What makes you think I've been crying?
There's a rainbow in your little blue eyes.
In the context of 1938, there had never been a character like Rochester, a recurring black character played by a black actor whose ethnicity was widely publicized in both the black and white presses. Moreover, he actually got to be funny, and not as a figure of ridicule. He was consistently depicted as more competent and level-headed than his boss, and like all of the white characters, he was able to land jokes at the star's expense.
Well, you could invite all the people that worked with you on that picture you made, The Horn Blows at Midnight.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. No, my house isn't big enough to hold all the people that worked on my picture. It'd be much too crowded.
Well, if you don't want a crowd, why don't you just invite the people who saw it?
Rochester, if you're trying to be funny, I got news for you. The Horn Blows at Midnight was seen by 12 million people.
Then how come it lost money?
The Warner Brothers wanted to make refunds. That was their business.
Edmund Lincoln Anderson Jr. was born September 18, 1905, in Oakland, California, to a show business family. His father performed with a troupe called the Georgia Minstrels, and his mother was a circus tightrope walker. Through the 20s and 30s, Eddie Anderson cut his teeth in both black and white vaudeville circuits, with a troupe called the Three Black Aces, as well as solo. He began mostly as a dancer, but his distinctive raspy voice led to comedy becoming an increasing part of his repertoire. Anderson had spent years as a minor performer in stage, radio, and film when he landed the role of Rochester, and became an almost immediate celebrity. His image was featured alongside his white co-stars on magazine ads for Jell-O and Lucky Strike cigarettes. In the show's feature film spin-offs like Love Thy Neighbor and Buck Benny Rides Again, he was a legitimate co-star with Benny and was advertised as such.
Now, Jack, how long have you been in radio?
Radio? Well, about 13 years.
And of those 13 years, how long would you say you've been a star?
Well, I don't know. I'd say 7 years.
7 years, uh-huh. And how long has Rochester been with you?
7 years.
Anderson parlayed his stardom into well-paying live engagements at top black theaters. And the week that Buck Benny Rides Again premiered in New York in 1940, he was guest of honor at a parade in Harlem and also joined his castmates for another parade outside the gala premiere at the Lowe's Victoria Theater. Anderson's Los Angeles mansion was featured on a postcard that was popular with black tourists. In 1943, he had his greatest movie role as the star of Vincent Minnelli's classic all-black musical Cabin in the Sky, a movie where he was funny, sad, and even got to sing.
Life's full of consequence, that old devil consequence. He takes all the frivol out of fun.
Anderson was written about, if condescendingly, in establishment media like the New York Times, and enjoyed a long honeymoon period with the black press. Still, there were limits to what he could do on a radio show with a white writing staff. In the character's early years, Rochester was sometimes prone to stealing, lying, and laziness, all tropes that would begin to rub liberal listeners the wrong way. In the 30s and 40s, Rochester was mostly segregated from the main action of the show. He would call Jack at the studio, or perform in scenes set at Jack's house, but there was little cause for him to interact with the rest of the cast. This was by design. Benny said as much in a 1940 interview with the New York Times when he said, quote, "Never is he supposed to be an actor or a part of the program. Always the audience thinks of him as my valet. That is why we never mention his name in the cast. The trick is to keep him in character," unquote. This remark hints at one of the most troubling aspects of Anderson's role on the show. He was credited only by his character's name, Rochester. While, for example, Jack's bandleader Phil Harris played a version of himself and enjoyed considerable celebrity independent of his role on the show, Eddie Anderson's identity was subsumed into his character.
The Lucky Strike program starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and yours truly, Don Wilson.
In October 1943, the show introduced a new character, Butterfly, played by Butterfly McQueen, well known for her role in Gone with the Wind. She was Rochester's clumsy niece.
Come on, Butterfly, we want to get seats down in front so Mr. Benny can hear me laughing and jokes.
Okay, Uncle Rochester. Say, how come Mr. Benny gave you a day off today?
I ain't hope, I got a lamb.
Butterfly worked alongside Rochester as Jack's maid, but Butterfly McQueen quit the show in early 1944. In an interview with Ebony magazine, she said, quote, "I don't mind playing maid parts occasionally, but I feel that I would be disgracing my race by always accepting parts as a menial to be not only laughed at, but looked down upon," unquote. For black critics, lingering questions about the Rochester character boiled over with the February 11, 1945 show, broadcast from a Navy base, where this exchange was enthusiastically received by the audience of sailors.
Rochester, do you mean that you started a crap game with some sailors?
Oh, no, boss. No, I didn't start it. You see, there were seven sailors standing around in a circle discussing Einstein's theory of relativity.
Uh-huh.
Then someone dropped a pair of dice and Einstein went AWOL.
The tropes about drinking and gambling went largely unnoticed by white listeners. but they caught the ire of the black press, leading to a slew of negative articles. The Chicago Defender newspaper encouraged its readers to write letters of disapproval to Lucky Strike, the show's sponsor. When Anderson was excluded from the Benny Show's USO tours in 1945, no less than Orson Welles published an open letter to Benny, objecting to the discrimination, but also taking both Benny and Anderson to task for relying on stereotypes. Welles wrote, quote, "Without meaning to at all, you and Eddie have been doing the Negro people a grave wrong. The gags about gin drinking and crap shooting are unusually good gags, and Eddie makes them sound hilarious, but through the years they've helped perpetuate a dangerous myth," unquote. Meanwhile, Anderson was also the target of more reactionary forces. His films faced cuts and even outright bans in southern communities. The 1943 release of Cabin in the Sky coincided with a rash of race riots. Some exhibitors decided it wasn't worth the hassle. In 1945, Brewster's Millions, in which Anderson was fourth billed, was banned in Memphis, where the chairman of the city's censor board wrote, quote, "We believe it presents too much familiarity between the races. It has Rochester in an important role. He has much too familiar a way about him, and the picture presents too much social equality and racial mixture," unquote. After the end of the Second World War, Anderson's brief period of movie stardom was over. A proposed spin-off radio show, The Adventures of Rochester, died in development. Throughout its run, The Benny Show also had to contend with a steady trickle of outraged letters from conservative listeners. Rochester was, after all, the only black character in mainstream American culture who talked back to his boss. One early controversy came in 1939, where Jack challenges his rival, Fred Allen, to a boxing match and recruits Rochester to be his sparring partner. Here's an extensive clip.
Hey, Rochester, put on the boxing gloves and work out with me.
Oh, no, not me.
Oh, come on, put on those gloves. I'm not going to hurt you.
I know that. I'm just tired.
Rochester, if you don't do it...
All right, boss, I'm putting them on.
That's better. Mary, hand me my glasses.
How are we going to box if you're wearing glasses?
Well, I got to see you, don't I?
Why don't you put on a suit of armor, too?
Now, the next one who says I'm a coward can't watch. All right, Rochester, and remember, no holding in the clinches, hitting below the belt is foul.
And over the fence is out.
Never mind that. Now, let's get going, Rochester. First, we'll spar around a little and get warmed up. Then I want you to tear right into me.
Okay, let's go.
Attaboy. What's the matter, Andy?
With you and Rochester sparring around, it looks like you're shadow boxing.
Yeah. Hey, Mary, how's my footwork?
Very flat.
It's a good thing they are. It's harder to knock me over. Hey, Andy, watch me get Rochester.
Okay, Buck.
Hey, Rochester, look. What's that behind you?
Well,
right there.
Ow!
I got you that time, Rochester. Boy, did I give you a black eye.
Black eye?
Yes.
You have to peel me to prove it.
You said it.
I think that was a dirty trick, Jack.
Never mind. If he was dumb enough to fall for it, it serves him right. All right, Rochester, come on. Put some snap into it. Say, I'm in better form than I thought I was.
Say, boss, your shoelace is untied.
My shoelace? Which one?
That one there.
Oh, yes, I'll have to... Ooh.
Jack, get up off the floor. Are you hurt?
Nerve. I'm looking from a bird's work.
Today we might cringe at some of the humor in that exchange. But at the time, the overwhelming controversy was that a black servant had dared punch his boss, even in the context of a sparring match. In his posthumously published autobiography, Benny wrote, quote, "Thousands of indignant persons below the Mason-Dixon line wrote in to complain that permitting my Afro-American butler to punch me in the face was an attack on the white race and the dignity of the South." This incident brought the heaviest mail we ever received on the program. You've got to realize that most of my life I've been a political innocent. It never occurred to me that there was anything offensive in this humorous little episode. I was amazed at this revelation of people's strong feelings on the subject of race. To me, I was just doing a comedy show.
from Hollywood, the Jack Benny Program, with his special guest, the Smothers Brothers.
When Jack Benny migrated to television, his show became less a show about a show than a sitcom about Jack Benny, vain and aging Hollywood star. Regular performers like Mary Livingston and Phil Harris either left the show or faded away. And with so much of the show unfolding in domestic spaces, the role of Rochester grew.
Oh, well, sir, what can I do for you?
Oh, I'm trying to get a guest for my boss.
Your boss, eh? Well, what would you like?
Well, I don't know. Maybe you got a suggestion.
Well, what kind of man is your boss? Is he the athletic type?
No.
Is he the intellectual type?
Well, no.
The executive type?
No.
Well, perhaps the outdoor type.
No.
Well, perhaps he's the playboy type.
No.
I'm afraid there isn't very much left.
That's him.
By this point, Benny and Anderson were American institutions. And if Anderson could never fully shake the Uncle Tom tag, it was also true that direct criticism in the black press had cooled. There was a long and subtle shift in his on-screen persona. Long gone were the jokes about gambling and carousing. As Catherine Fuller Seeley writes, quote, "On television, Rochester emerged as the most prominent character who talked back to Jack, criticized his poor decisions and cheapness with smart jokes and witty retorts, and who interacted with him most regularly. The longevity of Rochester's relationship with Jack and the fact they were played by the same actors for all those years also contributed to make them a taken-for-granted part of the media landscape," unquote. In 1950, Benny and Anderson appeared side by side on the cover of Look magazine, a landmark case of a white star sharing a cover with a black colleague. But what did Anderson think of his role in popular culture? He rarely gave interviews, and when he did, he was unfailingly complimentary towards Benny and his co-workers. Following Benny's death in 1974, he said this to CBS News.
I just can't completely to put words together that would really explain my feeling right now. A great loss. Just like a member of my family.
For the most part, Anderson avoided talking politics or positioning himself as anything other than a hardworking actor. But there were, over the years, some exceptions. During the Second World War, he was a spokesman for the United States war effort, giving speeches and radio addresses to help convince skeptical black Americans to enlist. In 1941, he took part in a broadcast on CBS for the National Urban League, in which, in character as Rochester, he politely called on white listeners to treat their black countrymen fairly. Among his remarks, quote, "He knows that he is a Negro and is glad to be, but first of all, he is an American, so let him be an American," unquote. The Jack Benny Show finished its long television run in 1965. Benny and Anderson appeared together one last time in a special called Jack Benny's Bag, which aired during the tumultuous year of 1968. The title was derived, of course, from hippie slang. In the show's concluding moments, the two men shared a joke about their dynamic in relation to the changing times.
"And now, because we haven't done a show together for 4 years, my lifelong friend, Rochester. Rochester, now the reason I brought you out, I want to tell you about a great idea I have for a new series we can do next year."
Good. What is it?"
"Well, we can be two tennis players who are really spies working for the CIA.
Hold it. That was done last season."
"Oh. Well, then we can play two bounty hunters in the post-Civil War period."
"Hold it. That's been done this season."
"Well, I have another idea. How about you coming back to work for me as my valet?"
"Hold it, Blue Eyes. We don't do that anymore."
that boat ends the scandal it creates, always keeps you on the run. Just when you're weakening, fate sends the deacon in, crash, and your cash ain't worth an ounce. 'Cause then comes the consequence, that old devil consequence. Fling.